Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
In the time available, I want to convince you that we need to wake up to the scale and impact of the sexual revolution which began half a century ago on Western culture and on the church. What is the sexual revolution, we ask? Well, for centuries, the Christian moral vision that human beings flourish when our sexual interests are bounded in a covenant relationship between a man and a woman, intrinsically open to children, that moral vision was in the mainstream of Western culture. In half a century, the Christian revolution refers to the process by which entirely new ideas and culture dismantled that vision and replaced it with something else, something quite different. And that is the sexual revolution that I want to convince you is impacting on your heart now as I speak, and on our churches, as well as radically on our wider culture. Well, how do we understand it, this vision? First, like all revolutions, this revolution is rooted in ideas. What did Martin Luther King say? If you want to change the world, he said, pick up a pen, write ideas. And this revolution, like all revolutions, is rooted in ideas. And I'll come on to one or two of the strands of these in just a moment. We can only pick up one or two strands, but if they have anything in common, if they have a common narrative, it's this, these ideas. It's a radical new vision about the role of sex and sexuality in human flourishing. It's a vision that opposes the traditional Christian moral vision as essentially being straitjacketing and impeding of human flourishing, and which seeks to replace it with a new, better vision and set of values based on freedom, individuality, and authentic self-expression. That's the common narrative of the sexual revolution. And there are several ideas, strands of ideas, which sit in that narrative. And the first I'd like to suggest to you is ancient Gnosticism. Ancient Gnosticism, the theologian Tom Wright says, is the great controlling myth of our age. And we've witnessed a surge of ancient Gnosticism among us. Now, of course, Paul struggled with the Gnostics. Gnosticism beleaguered the early church. It's been a part of our lives in different iterations, different forms over many centuries at different points in the Christian life. But remember that ancient Gnosticism is based in the notion that the outer world, culture, religion, these are accretions. These are an unreal experience which is essentially deceitful, deceptive of us. The real world is found inside. We need to cast off, to throw off the outer world, culture, religion, even our own bodies. Cast off the outer world. Search within you for the authentic you that you can unearth there, and be the you that you find, and express the you that you choose. That's the sort of narrative that threads its way through Gnosticism and expresses it in different forms. Now, the other big idea behind the sexual revolution is what I understand as a variant of Gnosticism, and it's queer theory. You heard of that? Queer theory. Queer theory, there are academic departments of queer theory, and if you listen carefully to the stormtroopers of the sexual revolution, they are expressing the ideas being generated within queer theory academia. And queer theory thinking, we would trace back to Michael Foucault, the philosopher, and to modern thinkers such as Judith Butler. And queer theory is again rooted in the idea that the outer is contestable. The felt experience of being embodied, male and female, is essentially a social construction, an accumulation of other people's ideas and insights and understandings, which inhibit and restrict your human felt experience. And so queer theory is once again about the liberation of the self from even the most fundamental, experience of being human, of say male and female. All of these are socially constructed accretions that inhibit human flourishing. Be free, be yourself. And so queer theory we see in the questioning of the boundaries of male and female and the merging of male and female. And so the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest brings into the public consciousness of what, 280 million people, the notion that there is no such thing as male or female. These are received categories which may be reconfigured at your choice. And of course this year's winner, as Stefan pointed out to the leaders the other day, having expressed some negative views about same-sex attraction, was quickly brought into line with the modern zeitgeist in his victory speech to say that we are all heroes, no matter what we believe, who we are, we're all heroes. And that's the modern zeitgeist. It's Gnosticism, and it's articulated with great sophistication in queer theory. So that's the first thing to get about the sexual revolution. It's a revolution that's rooted in ideas. Second, the sexual revolution, this is what we don't get very often, is not just rooted in ideas, it's a moral cause. You see, the mistake we often think is that the sexual revolution is some sort of moral inspiraling into degradation, and that we occupy the moral high ground and critique it from there. That is not the narrative. The stormtroopers of the sexual revolution see themselves as prosecuting a moral cause. And for the first time in centuries, Christians who walk in the orthodox vision of human flourishing find that they are now an immoral minority. Not just a cognitive minority, we are an immoral minority seen by the moral mainstream, redefined as being fundamentally immoral, out of step, wrong side of history. And it's a very interesting place to be emotionally. Now, I think we might understand this a little better if we look at the work of psychologists such as Jonathan Haidt with his moral foundations theories. Some of you may have seen this fascinating work. Now, what Jonathan Haidt argues is that when faced with human with moral problems, human beings think more gut level than cognitively. We respond at gut level. And he says we tend to respond to moral questions along a limited number of channels of cognitive gut level systems, cognitive/gut level systems. One of these, there are six of them, he suggests, possibly more, but one of them is care harm. So the question we ask when faced with a moral quandary is anybody being harmed here? Let's be compassionate. What's happening? Is harm being done? That's the first question. Another one, the second one is concern for fairness. Concern for freedom. Is anybody being oppressed, trodden down by the weak over the strong? That's another gut level moral evaluation that we make. And then there's concern for loyalty to those around us, to our friends. What do my friends think about? What are people whose opinions I value, who've looked out for me all of these years? What do they think? Because it matters. It's a moral issue to me that I'm loyal to that tradition. And then, of course, authority itself. What have our people thought about this down through the centuries? Before we go turning this over, let's think, because they may have accumulated these ideas with good cause. And then finally, what Haidt calls the sanctity, or the opposite is the degradation, moral instinct. And this is an instinctive desire to hold to what is sacred for the good of the community. This is the kind of thinking where we say, look, hang on a minute, are we dismantling some big ideas here? Ideas that are about everybody's flourishing, sacred ideas that we maybe question at our cost. After all, we may say it, you know, this kind of thinking goes, it's no good meeting the needs of a subset of the bees if in doing so you destroy the whole hive. That's that kind of sacred thinking, you see. Now, what's so interesting about Haidt's work is he says that if whatever culture you go to, these kind of six moral concerns, you'll find them at work. But if you look within cultures, human beings differ when they're faced with a moral problem in the relative weight that they give to these different moral concerns. And he's done a lot of work on political left versus right. And he says if you're typically politically left, you tend to gravitate to certain concerns, and if you're on the right politically and socially conservative, you gravitate to other concerns and you emphasize them. Okay? Now, if you're on the political left, what are the concerns you think people instinctively come into play when they're faced with a moral problem? What do you think?
Care.
Is anybody getting hurt here? That's what I'm bothered about. It's the individual. What else?
Fairness.
You know, is it fair? Is anybody being downtrodden? It's the underdogs that we want to include now, you see. And what are social conservatives? Conservatively minded people, they conserve. So it's not hard to see that they tend to think about the traditions of the elders and our group, our kind of people, and what they think, and sacred values that we have been entrusted with. Now, what I suggest to you is it looks rather like this. We've got people on the left tend to deploy these moral instincts, and people on the right tend to deploy these moral instincts. Now, what is happening if you look at debates, the culture of wars over sexuality, is that people fall into very similar groups. And so the person, for example, who's an advocate of gay marriage, says, you see, what concerns me is who's getting harmed here? This person's been beaten down, they're on the margins, they've been a nobody. Queers, string them up, fags, the sort of people who have been oppressed, you know. I think they're getting hurt and it's time they got a fair deal. You know, is marriage good enough for you? You say, I believe in marriage because it strengthens the bonds between people. Then why isn't it good enough? Why isn't it fair for those people over there? See, I don't think you're being very fair. I think you're cheating on these people and you're oppressing them and you're using your authority of the church and the state and all of that to sit on these people. I'm on their side. We're inclusive. Now, you see that narrative. We all know this narrative because it is etched into our imaginations by rom-coms and sitcoms and dramas and documentaries every day. That's the narrative that's out there. Meanwhile, over on the other side, people like us try to argue in the public square about, well, the authority of the Bible. And we want to be true to what our church has said about this and our friends, and we want to we feel there are sacred values and that God has given marriage as something that's good, you see. But the problem is that these two sides talk past each other. One side seems to be compassionate, the other side seems to be cared about what the Bible says, and these traditions and sacredness. Don't know what that means, sanctity. So we have a very interesting dynamic going on, and what in the public square we've often failed to see is that those who oppose the traditional Christian vision, they have a moral cause. Whether we like it or not, they think that they're on the side of the right. And some genuinely think that. Others, well, it's a great way of appearing publicly righteous. And one of the things that Haidt and other social psychologists show is that we are social animals hungry to be seen as publicly righteous. And we will fall in with whatever way that comes easiest to show our public morality. Now, there's lots of social psychology to show that you get us on our own and we act very differently, selfishly, in our self-interest. But publicly, we desire to be like, well, we're Pharisees. And so there are all kinds of ways as culture changes in which we're called upon to indicate our alignment with the new moral vision. And we can do it on Twitter. Somebody says, heroes, we're all heroes. Yeah, we tweet that. That's easy. It's a nice phrase. And I feel a little better. So we're in a powerful social revolution, friends. That's a revolution of ideas. It's a revolution of moral thought and moral intention. We need to understand this. Thirdly and finally, in the last couple of minutes, I want to argue that it's not just rooted in ideas, it's not simply a moral vision. This new sexual revolution has narrative power. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Charles Taylor, the philosopher, he said, what we need to understand is that many of the big ideas that have changed culture and that continue to change culture are held in the public imagination, the social imaginary, as stories. He says secular, that our modern secularism isn't held in the public imagination as a list of facts. It's held as a story. It's the story about how oppressive, retrograde church views were overcome in the Enlightenment with science and new thinking. And it's a story with heroes and villains. The hero, Galileo, villains, the Catholic Church. You know who's which, and we feel the excitement as a new revolution takes place. And the point is, Charles Taylor says, is that stories have power over the human imagination, and they engage our interest and our commitment in a way over and above. They have power over and above the facts themselves that make up that story. So Charles Taylor says, it's no use fighting a story, a narrative, with a list of facts. You need another story. And so the question I want to leave you with, friends, is what we've done in the public square and in our own churches is we've responded to this massive social revolution with profound intellectual poverty. This place, full of apologists, wonderful apologists, who'll tell us about cosmology and the moral basis of our ethical thinking and about fine-tuning arguments. I have to say, friends, when I go out for dinner, nobody asks me about cosmology. When you sit down, the first question when you say you're Christian is, so what do you think about gay marriage? And yet our engagement with this in terms of the Christian mind apologetics has been abysmal. Poor. There are very few people engaging with queer theory in academia of Christian conviction. I have to say, I was having a little rant about this a couple of years ago, and there was a guy sitting here, and he bounded up to me last year, and he said, I just want you to know, I'm moving to England, I've got a fully funded PhD for 3 years in queer theory. I thought, wow, you know, what an answer to prayer. Start with one. We start with one. But we need a new intellectual engagement with this. Young intellectuals. And we need to understand that in the morality and culture wars, we have come across very often as defending our own position and not understanding the moral concerns of our opponents. We've come across as people defending our view and being persecuted and being concerned about us. And quite rightly, people out there, they say, yeah, but you don't seem very concerned about them. Where's your compassion? Where's your care? And what we need to do is to begin to make our arguments here in ways, if you see, let's go red, that play across the all six spectra, of all six sections, channels of the moral spectrum. And then finally, and I'm finishing now and inviting you to chip in and push back, we are exposing our young people to what I call the double jeopardy of shame. And I want you to think about this, because one of the tragedies of our Christian culture is that we are a shame culture when it comes to sex and sexuality. You know, most of us were brought up here, we were left to explore our bodies and discover it for ourselves. Nobody really introduced us to the biblical vision of what it means to be sexed, male and female, to have sex, what sex is for. These were left to our exploration, our imagination. And the sense of shame quickly became palpable in our cultures. And so what's happening is our young people continue to inherit this because of our silence about this issue, because of our lack of narrative. And they feel ashamed in church, but for the first time, what's happening? They're going outside of church into secular culture, and they discover that they're an immoral minority there as well, and they feel shame. Because their friends seem to be compassionate and on the side of equality and fairness, and they seem to be bigoted. That's the narrative that they're being exposed to. And this is a double jeopardy of shame, and the human spirit cannot sustain it. Which is why we're losing young people, as I speak, in our churches. They're not saying it, they're feeling it right now, this shame. And if we continue to leave the situation as it is, we're in dire danger. And that is the argument I wanted to make these 22 minutes. So let's stop there, and we've got some time to chip in together. The question is, do we not realize, though, that the paradigm has shifted so quickly that actually the people being oppressed are those who hold those old views about Christian moral values? And I think that's a really good point. And if we were thinking about how we might play into this new environment, that's something that we need to be mindful of. That because I think that people will become gradually aware that this is going on. If Haidt's correct, there will be people out there who will say, hang on a minute, you know, I'm pro-gay marriage, but I don't like what we're doing to Christians. And I think we have to work with them and form some kind of alliance with them. Now, for example, someone tweeted, I remember, after the chief executive of, was it Google or no, one of the big web-based firms, Brendan, he was basically sacked because he donated
Firefox,
he was sacked because he'd made a donation to traditional marriage advocacy a few years previously, and he was forced out of his job in one way or another, at any rate, whether he was sacked or not, he felt that he was forced out. But I saw a few tweets, and one tweet says, you know, I'm pro-gay marriage, but I didn't come out of the closet myself as a gay man to put Christians in the closet. And so I think that, you know, we are made in the image of God. There is out there, even in those who we would have seen as our opponents, there are some people who are saying, hang on a minute, this is potentially going too far. I think we need to forge an alliance with them if we're being strategic. I said there are two strands. There are a number of strands that we may see as feeding into the overarching narrative that we've got something good here about human flourishing that opposes that old Christian narrative. But absolutely take that point. Thanks. That's the Frankfurt School. If you want to go away and Google that, yes. So what you're saying is that I've come up with a couple of root ideas, but are they sufficient to explain this whole development, this whole cultural development? Just before I respond to that, thanks so much. You know, in 20 minutes, we can cut this cake in a number of ways. And what I want to do is stimulate you to start cutting the cake, you know. And if you don't think I've cut it in a way that really works, you know, cut it, my friend, a different way, and let's get thinking together in a way that creates some energy and excitement, because there just isn't that at the moment. So I'd really welcome that point. Are you a reader of Charles Taylor? Do I detect some Charles Taylor in there? No, but certainly, you know, his notion of secularism is the plurality of ideas, which is so dangerous, because no, we don't engage with one idea because, hey, it's just one of several. Everything is always one of several, and it's this fluidity of intellectual life which he feels has become so dangerous and toxic to the to Christian values and beliefs. But I take your point. You know, secularism itself has upturned the notion of there being a truth, of there being a way in which we are called to walk, of there being anything given to which we are called. And in a sense, you would argue that if the universe is devoid of any meaning, that we're not furnished with any natural way of doing things, it's entirely consistent with that to say that you must therefore self-construct, make yourself up as you go along. And you know, that's, and I suppose in terms of a sociocultural critique, the individualism of the 60s was a perfect social crucible for these new ideas, because what the new economic prosperity did is it put stash money into the pockets of young people like me, who left home and went to university and became much freer of those old bonds, those old social and family bonds, is that we could start thinking for ourselves. And there was that whole 60s individualism, let it hang out, and 70s sort of me generation that provided a social crucible for the nurture of those. So it's a great point, and we could, in a way, I suppose, pull back the lens of ideas. You know, so take that point. Thank you. Point just being made is that, you know, the big question all this raises is how do we engage with this in a thoughtful, positive way? You know, I think that's a really... Well, you know, we keep pulling the lens back. This is what this is all about. It's certainly a strand that I've, when I've written on this, I've identified. I just simply call it radical feminism, because the notion that the traditional Christian moral vision is inimical to, antithetical to human flourishing, was also driven by radical feminism, which viewed patriarchy as being oppressive of women. You know, what Christian thinking, and it's all packaged in together, there's a relate, you know, they're linked, did for women is it closeted lesbians, it shamed single mothers, and it, you know, all of those things. And so the entire moral vision became tethered to those kinds of insights, which we need to concede in part. You know, that there were aspects. I think that's behind your question. Let's realize that this isn't coming from nowhere, that there are some legitimate criticisms of Christian thinking. Is that what you're saying there?
Yes.
Yeah. Brother here making a great point, just for the audio, that he's rather skeptical about any hope in the public square at the moment. I have to say I share that. I am skeptical too, but not hopeless. But I am skeptical. I think, you know, we've lost massively and it's going to take a while. And I absolutely share your concern that it's the pace in which this argument is being lost in our own churches that really ought to be concerning us now.